Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, tennis fans from around the globe. The following program is a presentation of the Yellow Ball Network.
Are we on?
Yep, we're on.
All right, let's go.
Broadcasting live from the Tennis Dynamic Studio in downtown Marietta, Georgia, this is the We Coach Tennis Radio Show on the Yellow Ball Network. Your host for the show this week is J.P. Weber.
Everybody, welcome back to the We Coach Tennis Radio Show. We've been off the air for several weeks. I had surgery, and it was a little bit more involved than I thought it was going to be, so we've been off the air. But if you are listening in and you'd like to talk to us, if you'd like to call in, you can call in on the We Coach Tennis hotline, 646-652-4856. And if you... Want to listen in, you can catch it on a podcast. You can download it on iTunes and go to iTunes and get it there. And we are going to get started here. We're going to take a quick commercial break before we get started. There's not much going on at this point. Hopefully we'll have a few guests call in. If not, well, we'll just have a good time talking about a few things otherwise. So let's take a quick commercial break, and we will come right back.
Join us for the We Coach Tennis Show. Call 646-652-4856. We Coach Tennis.
Please join us for the 2016 Marietta Grand Prix presented by Resurgence Orthopedics and HandmadeCharlotte.com. These tournaments are a lot of fun.
Hey, thanks, buddy. Man, you got to take it from the kids. The 2016 Marietta Grand Prix series of tournaments is a great alternative to the cookie-cutter tournaments you encounter every weekend. Be a part of something game-changing. The Grand Prix Series of Tennis Tournaments is a great part of tennis development and gives players super match play opportunity. These one-day events are held on Saturdays only. There's no USTA membership required. The tournaments are open to adults and juniors. You get match play, lunch, and a chance to earn great prizes. And hey, coaching is allowed, and we'll feed the coaches for free. Matches are played on 78-foot courts using regulation yellow balls. So come join us on Saturdays from 11 to 4 and have a great competitive day.
We like yellow ball. We like yellow ball.
Hi, everyone. We are proud of the 2016 Marietta Grand Prix sponsor, HandmadeCharlotte.com. That's HandmadeCharlotte.com. Go to their website and discover the magic in everyday life. Find great do-it-yourself projects and learn about creative, family-oriented ideas for food, holidays, home interiors, and more one-of-a-kind finds. That's www.handmadecharlotte.com.
I am so pleased to have Resurgence Orthopedics as presenting sponsor for the 2016 Marietta Grand Prix. I've been using Resurgence myself for over 15 years. The doctors and staff at Resurgence are incredibly kind and capable. Anyone who's ever had to take care of me knows that I'm one of the worst patients in the world. And through several procedures, their team has always given me excellent care. The doctors and staff at Resurgence take the stress out of going to the doctor, as they are so patient and will spend whatever time is needed so you can feel confident in knowing you're going to get better. For example, I recently had a surgery, and during the post-operative rehab, I needed to be fitted for a brace. Both the doctor and the staff spent all kinds of time with me to help me get it right. I even had to go back for two follow-up visits to tweak it in order to have it adjusted, and they were happy to do it just right for me. Hey, and here's another thing. The Resurgence Patient Portal, which keeps me in constant contact with my doctors and the staff, even connects through the scales at my home. Resurgence has 21 locations throughout the Metro Atlanta area. They provide patients with a full range of orthopedic diagnostic and rehabilitative services. Resurgence really is the best. Reach for more with Resurgence Orthopedics. Look them up on the web at resurgence.com.
Hi, this is Coach Chuck Creasy. I take great pride in calling it the way it is. It's a meat and potato principle of coaching that no one really cares what you know unless they know that you care. As a parent also, I want this and very skilled hands working with my youngster. Coach J.P. Weber's 30 years of experience speaks for itself. Go see him at Laurel Park in Marietta, Georgia. His website is tennisdynamics.net. Tennisdynamics.net.
Okay, we're back here. What is today? It's Tuesday the 8th of March. This past weekend, we were out at, I was out watching matches at the Lifetime Fitness Center in Norcross. And it's amazing to me the amount of money that they have put into to that place. The driveway in alone, if it's set up just right, the driveway alone is worth quite, I can't even imagine how much that would end up being. But I went out and watched matches, and you see matches at a high level. You saw some good play. It was a, you know, when I say a high level, it was a decent level. It was a level four. I guess when I say it's high compared to coming back to the park and watching some of the middle school stuff. And I see quite the divide in what's going on out there. And I don't know that what I call dumbing down of the tennis is the best thing for the participation. When I look at what I see in the different levels, and I see where kids are competent in playing, and I see where they're being produced and who's producing them, and they're the bulk of the players. They're the ones that drive the rest of the play that goes on. When I see all that, and then I come back and see the lower level of play where it's done as an activity or a recreational situation, it's a large canyon between those two. I think I'm beginning to see more and more of that. And what I think, to me at least, what it seems to me is, as I look at it, the divide comes when we are making every attempt to make the game itself seem to or appear to be easy to become good at or competent at it. And when we do that, and when we try to put it together in that fashion, I think that it makes it tougher to then get those kids or to bridge that gap that exists out there. Now, they may look at it differently. They may look at it and say, you know, from their standpoint, from their research and the marketing and everything else that they're doing, that they're increasing participation, but I haven't seen it. And I don't think that if there was an increased amount of participation, that would be good, that it would be such as it is now. I find it remarkable. I was noticing too, let's see, I'm just trying to come up with a few things that are going on lately. This is I've just got back, right now I'm actually
see here. In my bed, I've got a machine going on my leg. It's going back and forth and back and forth, and it's mobilizing my leg from the treatments that they've been doing. So I'm going to take some callers here in a few minutes, but that was the one thing I did notice. I went out to Lifetime and I saw, again, incredible the amount of money that they've put into the place there. Very few people there, very few members playing tennis. The levels that I see around, I'm seeing great chasms in the difference. I see kids that can play, and I see that beginning to narrow. I don't see that as widespread. And then I'm seeing an enormous amount at the bottom that, and when I say enormous amount, I'm just seeing many more who, and it's perhaps it's an Atlanta thing. We have 8 weeks a year here that we play out, or 8 weeks of a season that we do the Alta tennis, and then people are off and they don't play again until the next season at all. And so when that happens, it creates a difference, you know, for the tennis. Hold on, I'm going to take a caller here real quick. Let me grab this. This is difficult today. Let me grab a caller. Caller, you there? Is this a 315 area code?
Yeah, I'm a 315 man. How you doing, big guy?
Good. Who is this?
All in the rehab. It's all in the rehab.
Is this Luke?
Don't take any of this Sharapova stuff. Get right to the rehab, to the knee bend, the resistance bands. Eat right.
Oh, I'm in the ball. I'm in a machine right now, and it is it's moving me through all the stuff that it's supposed to do. But I got to sit in this thing for 8 hours a day, so it's a long. It's not up. I've got it at 90 degrees, and when it gets up to about 8, it's hurting. It's hurting a good bit.
Yeah. When are you out of that machine?
I don't get out of this machine until, I guess it'll be another 4 weeks, 4 or 5 weeks.
Holy cow. That's rough, dude.
It's a lot of rehab. It's a lot of rehab.
It's a lot of rehab.
A lot of work.
But you'll be back at it, hitting those kickers.
So did you come up this weekend to watch the boys play?
Yeah, Cartersville, we had a level 3, man. You were dodging us. I hear you talking about some going down the Lifetime at a level 4. I think you're sandbagging. You got to come up to Cartersville.
I actually enjoy, believe it or not, that's a much more crutch-friendly place up there in Cartersville than the Lifetime place.
So we wheelchair access. We got the whole thing. We've got, you know,
you had it all,
anything.
Man.
We got Braille for the blind. Cartersville's got it going.
So help me with what I'm struggling here. I was talking a little bit about this. I see a sort of a gap that's maybe, and maybe it's just my imagination. Maybe it's just what I'm seeing. I'm seeing a gap between, I know that there's a lot of efforts at the grassroots level to increase tennis and to do better with it. But I'm seeing, I feel like there's a little bit of, I'll give you a good example. Let me try and do it this way. A couple weeks ago, I was with you, I went down and watched you came down to Sea Island and saw the boys play your nephews at that tournament, and you made a simple comment about how they can't volley anymore because they won't even hit the ball to one another volleying wise. You know, it's a rip here and a rip there, and I don't know if that's the case, but I do see a widening. It seems to me, at least at the lower levels, a widening gap. I see where you've got kids that are playing at tennis. And you know, attempting it, and then you've got kids that are actually working at it and getting better at it. And I don't know if that's always been there like that. I think that at some point the recreational kid was a little bit better tennis player than what we've got today, possibly. Do you think I'm just imagining that, or
I see the kids. No, I see the kids globally. Because I still travel around the world for events, and you know, there's so much talent. I mean, kids are doing things with the tennis ball at ages that only a few really could do. The standouts like Tracy Austin, a Capriati, an Andre Agassi, a Steffi Graf, these phenoms you knew were coming through the pipeline that had exceptional talent. Now I see kids, you know, are honestly technically very sound, can volley, can serve, can do a lot of things. And that's because of, you know, really the globalization of how to teach technique, whether it's the PTA or PTR and the efforts for the last 30, 40 years there. There's some really good coaching. The fast food approach where you feed a lot of balls to these kids and they stroke the ball really well. I think overall they play better. But then you watch them compete, and that's where I think you're seeing this chasm, this widening between the players and the wannabe players, the kids who hit tennis balls or hit tennis instead of play or create tennis. And when we grew up, we didn't have the hoppers and we didn't have the shopping carts and balls. It was kind of like take a couple balls out, two or three balls, hit on the wall, play sets, learn how to, you know, how to deal with 15-30, when to serve and volley, when to moon ball, just all these different situations that we had to do. Today's player is more rounded in the technical sense, but the tactical sense, I think they're lacking because they don't have the match point.
Do they get the strokes that allow them to be tactically sound? Does that make sense? Do the strokes
that
match
I have
the tactic?
Seen, yeah, I mean, we have level fours and fives at Sea Island. I've been going to level fours and fives, and I've been to Kalamazoo and the Easter Bowls and all that stuff, and even the Orange Bowls and the Wimbledon Juniors, the U.S. and French Junior Championships, I see that. In the collegiate level of play, I think the technique is there. It's the awareness of playing the right shot. Temperament is always going to be tricky. I can see kids getting frustrated right out of the first or second game. They don't have the patience or the poise. And that's something that coaches have to really emphasize, how mentally tough you have to be and the kind of attitude you want to project on the court. But it's the willingness to prepare the right way. Are you preparing to hit a tennis ball? Are you preparing to win a tennis match? And I think that's really the big difference. When I ask players, what have you identified as the weakness of your opponent? And they don't know. Well, I'm not really – you know, my thing is, are you looking to the other side in competition under pressure? And are you committing to that strategy to try to either change it or attack it to try to win matches? And then, you know, you've got to lose before you win. You got to build on all these setbacks and all this adversity to reach success. It doesn't come automatically. So it's fun to watch it. It's fun to analyze it. It's really neat to see truly American tennis with so many people passionate about it, so much money being invested into it, the United States Tennis Association putting in $20 million a year to develop the next Wimbledon champion from the United States.
Well, they've got so much money. You know, they've got a lot to put in there. You know, I made the comment. I went out there and I talked a little bit. You know, have you been to the Lifetime Center there in Norcross?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
It's gorgeous.
I love that place.
It's absolutely gorgeous. And I'm a little bit worried because there are certain weekends and things that there's certain times of the week that I'm not full at the park. And I went out there, and if they didn't have that tournament, they wouldn't have had a lot of people. Tennis in general in the U.S., do you see it on an upswing since you have such a global – is it coming forward? Are we getting – do you see it coming up? Or do they share any numbers with you? Because I can't get anybody – I can't get the USGA or ALTA or anybody to give me any real good numbers to know whether or not it's becoming it's coming back.
The people I talk to is the TIA, the Tennis Industry of America, some really good numbers.
Okay.
I'm really big on that website. I get a lot of, I think 26 million Americans played in 2014. We haven't gotten the 2015 stats out yet, but in some capacity, that's someone who picks up racket for the first time all the way to John Isner and Roger Federer, who plays the U.S. Open. Someone in the United States, whether they're from the U.S. or not, in this country, are buying tennis balls, using tennis courts, facilities and things like that. So it's a very healthy number. I think we have about 250 million people in our country, coast to coast. So it's really interesting to me. I see an uptick in my business, Sea Island. We had a great year, and we're making money, and we're really pumping the game at this level. We have 2 8-court clay court facilities, and people enjoy playing on clay. Kids are playing. We've got all types of programs, reach out programs that we work with the USTA. Whether it's the Georgia USTA or the national and southern level of USTA. And it's been a lot of fun to kind of take risks, try some things. We have tournaments and things, and we're working on camps now. I think the game is on an uptick. We will need someone like an Agassi, someone who has some star power, and maybe Taylor Fritz, this young American, who was the number one junior in the world last year, just reached the finals of Memphis, which is a key tour stop in the United States on the ATP tour. And he lost to Nishikori in a close match. So I think we're on our way.
I'm going to grab another caller in here. I think this is Bruce Lipka from Maryland. Bruce, are you there?
I'm here, JP.
We've got Luke Jensen on and Bruce Lipka. Bruce is a director of tennis at the Woodmont Country Club, Luke, in Baltimore. And, Bruce, you've been listening a little bit with Luke and I. I see sort of a chasm. Maybe I'm not able to articulate exactly what it is. Luke says he sees a little bit. He defined it more as they're unable to play competitively well. Would you say, is that a good way to say it, Luke? They're unable to
compete? Yes, match play-wise, tactically, because they don't play the sets that players used to play as kids. The 15-30s, the break points, maybe even the set points down elude them tactically. But technically, I see a very good player.
What are you seeing, Bruce?
Well, I think the Luke made many, many relevant points that we could expound upon for hours. To take what y'all just said, I believe that the challenge begins. It does begin with the pro. And when you talk about tactics and technique and you talk about competing, there's two concepts there. One concept is the raw competitor, the guy who, in the juniors, there aren't a lot of pushers anymore. Pushers used to win a whole hell of a lot because they were gritty and they ran balls down and they kept the ball in play. And somehow people have convinced them that that's not cool anymore. So kids, they want to go for shots and they miss a lot of balls. Part of competing, of course, is being consistent. Part of competing is having a certain amount of toughness to fight through. Part of competing is being able to be at your worst on your worst day and find a way to succeed. That's part of competing, and in order to compete that way, one must fail first. And the mommies and daddies in the United States these days don't like little Jimmy, Johnny, and Jane failing all the time. So they make excuses for them, and they bail them out, and they do all kinds of other things. And I don't know how a kid's ever going to learn to compete and to overcome adversity unless they experience adversity. I mean, so there's certainly that's certainly a huge problem that we have. We see players, and you don't have to be poor from a horrible place to become a great tennis player. Nothing about Roger Federer's background or Nadal's background says that they were poor and grew up in a ghetto somewhere and had this burning desire to get out of the ghetto. But you do have to be able to compete, and whether that's genetic or whether it's environmental, whatever it is you experience that gets you there, competing is a very important thing. The comment about the tactics and the technique, I do believe that Luke is correct. Everybody hits the ball well nowadays. Kids who are ranked 35 in the Mid-Atlantic and who are terrible look fantastic. And I believe the chasm there that is created is that as a professional in this business, whether I was coaching tour players at the college level, at the club level, the juniors, mm-hmm. I have a base philosophy that I always go back to in every area of what I do. And when it comes to this subject that y'all are talking about, I teach technique based on the tactics I would like to employ, as opposed to, I think, a lot of the professionals. And we just held the Mid-Atlantic USPTA convention, and I saw this firsthand, unfortunately, from several of the presentations. Guys are just teaching technique for the sake of teaching technique, so that the kids look good and they have good, quote, good technique. And I think the flaw that exists is that if you don't teach the technique with the tactics in mind that you want the kids to employ, or the adult player or the pro player or the lady on the 2-5 team, then you're teaching an empty methodology. Because now someone, you know, I see folks telling kids they want them to go to the net, and they got them hitting in an open stance on both sides, which makes it great to play defense back there, but makes it very difficult to move forward in the court. You know, I got kids, people not teaching kids to hit serves a certain way, maybe a little less pace, maybe a little kick, maybe a little more accurate to serve and volley behind, but they hit the serve as hard as they can, only worried about the speed of the serve. But you can't learn to serve and volley behind to serve like that. It's not possible. You know, you can't learn to come and play the net if every time the ball's ankle high, you take a full topspin swipe at it. You're going to have to be able to make an approach in order to learn how to hit a volley. You know, and it's and it builds on itself. And I think, you know, something I heard a tone in what Luke was saying, or you said something about the kids playing together and they can't learn to volley. You know, one of the other missing pieces is you've got to be cooperative. You know, you got to have a practice partner who you can be cooperative with. And when you're playing that guy, and you come to the net and you miss a passing shot, you got to be able to look at the guy and say, give me another one. And the guy feeds you another ball to the same spot, and now you hit the pass, and now you've got the picture to replace the miss with. You know, you've got a guy who makes the first serves. You make the returns. He makes the first volleys. You learn to hit passing shots. And then you artificially set up the game. Okay, you're down. Break point, 30-40. Let's play from here right now. And you can practice the different situations, but that requires – you know, either a specialized practice or you playing so many sets that it comes up very often. And the kids don't play the sets. They go to the group, you know, where they can hide in the group and they can wait in line and they can hit some balls and they can get prizes and they can play with green balls and yellow balls and red balls, and it's hard to do. And, you know, but like Chuck always says, whatever's most difficult to pick up is most difficult to put down. You know, it's something that's easy to pick up. You know, a lot of people start playing checkers, but I'm not sure how many people still play it. But people who start playing chess continue to play it. Tougher to learn, tougher to put down.
Bruce, Luke, let me ask you. You know, I think we have, Luke, we have a lot more tournaments than when you and I and Bruce, when we were all about in the same era. There are more tournaments now than there were then. You would think that the kids could play better competitively, no? What do you think, Luke?
Well, during the week, it's very interesting. Are they playing sets in practice situations where there isn't as much pressure? We just used to combine it. I remember growing up just having a combination of a private lesson once or twice a week with a group situation once or twice a week. But then there was always – I used to always play guys who were back from college or former college players or – anybody where we'd just play, I don't know, 2 days a week or so, we'd play three sets. When I got to college, Coach Dick Leach at Southern Cal made us play 3 out of 5 sets because that was the Grand Slam standard. And even though in college we were only playing three sets, a lot of our stuff, at the high performance stuff, was really best of 5 sets, and you're going to have to iron it out and find a way, endurance-wise, mentally and physically. But I think it's just a balance to really find that. And I think Bruce has, you know, come up with such a great, you know, kind of view on what, you know, coaches are really teaching out there. The technique looks great, but at some point you got to be able to put that in under pressure.
You know, both of you are mentioning something that happened. I think that the matches, and Bruce, I remember you did a great thing. I remember you were talking about doing a cartoon. It was several years ago, and you were talking about, in the first panel, having the today's players, and they've got 5 different sets of lines, 5 different colors of balls, 5 different sizes of rackets, and then in the second, you know, and the kids are kind of wondering what to do, and there's a, you know, and then in the second panel, you had a kid turning, and or maybe it was in the second panel, you had the kids, they were imagining back with one racket at a park, hitting with each other, and there was a thought bubble of one kid. He was dreaming he was McEnroe, and then there was a thought bubble above the other kid, and he was dreaming he was Borg. And then in the last panel, I think you said the kid tosses the racket over his neck and says, "I'm going to go play golf. This is too complex." We've got so businesslike and so, you know, like Luke said, you know, during the week, are they playing sets? I try to get them out, and, you know, I have all assigned
well,
to go out and play.
What Luke said there, Luke said something more important, though. I think what Luke said was more important, and Luke said they'd have 1 or 2 lessons per week. You know, in Florida growing up, number one, there was literally a tournament within a 15-minute drive every single weekend. This was the tennis boom. And the junior tournament at Holiday Park was a 256 draw. And the only reason I started playing tennis is because back then, tournaments started on Fridays. So you got to miss school. So I thought, wow, this is awesome. I'm going to be a tennis player and miss school every Friday. Until my dad said, if he loses first round, you get his ass to class by 9:30 because we played 8 o'clock. But what Luke said was that he took 1 or 2 hours a lesson. You know, we used to get half an hour or a one-hour lesson, and that was in a week. And our lesson was a lesson. Our lesson was not the repetition work that needed to be done in order to become a tennis player. If you wanted to become a tennis player, you have to go out and do the repetition. You have to do it on your own. And I'll make this analogy for you that I made for one of the kids who I work with. I couldn't get through to him, so I asked him, I said, you know, how do you do in school? And he says, good, I make straight A's. I say, okay, super, take me through the day. Well, I sit in class and I take some notes, and you know, then we also have study hall every day. And then after school, I go home and I do my homework at night. And, you know, in the morning, sometimes on the ride to school, if I have a test first period, I might be reviewing. You know, sometimes my parents get me a tutor, you know, to help me a little bit if I'm struggling in a class. And I said, oh, so when you get the tutor, you don't study anything else? He says, no. On top of everything else I do. And sometimes during lunch period, if he has a test after lunch, then he goes off. He doesn't go to lunch in the lunchroom. He eats very quickly, goes to the library, studies. So I said, well, this is why you have straight A's. You're a straight A student. You put all the work in. Now we go to the tennis player. And I say to him, you know, how often are you going home and doing homework at night? Do you jump rope at night? Are you shadowing? Are you doing visualizing? Are you going to the wall at the middle school half a mile from your house, hitting on the wall? No, none of those things. How often as you're on the ride to your match at your tournaments, are you visualizing what you want to do? Are you writing out your game plan? And these are things I've asked them to do. I'm not trying to see if someone on their own is doing something. I believe those are the Federers of the world. Those are the really unique people, the outliers. So I've outlined for this boy what the program looks like and what needs to be done. And he's still not doing it because he views our time together when we have a lesson as also repetition, and he's not learned to pay the dues himself. You know, when Luke's a kid and when I'm a kid and we're going out there and playing sets, and you play the kid who's 2 years younger than you who you didn't want to lose to because that's embarrassing, and you play the kid who's older than you who you wanted to beat to show them, hey, I'm as good as you, there was a sense of pressure all the time. And then when Bob Sassano sent me out there to play a girl, by God, I was going to fight like hell, and I had to find the tactic to beat the girl. I mean, so you learned to play tennis, not to hit the ball. And I think, and that's the words I use to describe what Luke is saying. There's a big difference between how to hit a ball and how to play tennis. And it's rare that the guys know how to play tennis or the gals anymore, but they all know how to hit the ball. And it's beautifully done, but they do not play tennis well.
Let me ask you, you touched on something. You know, there's been a lot of criticism. Maybe, Luke, I'd love to hear you on this, too. I like what you said there, Bruce, because what I try to do is I still subscribe to a certain degree to that half-hour lesson a week kind of thing, maybe once, maybe twice. But in that half-hour lesson, my goal is to teach them something or to work on something real specific that they need. Then what I want out of the half-hour lesson, I want to then turn the onus onto them that now they're going to go 2 courts away, they're going to, you know, be with somebody else, and they're going to work on that slice backhand, or they're going to work on that forehand slice, or they're going to work on something like that. And that's not really what I don't think sells, at least in the populace. In the populace, you know, it's a large shopping cart, it's a lot of fed balls, and it's a constant structured thing. And so what you two mentioned was, in your lives and your growing up, you both became very accomplished players, certainly more accomplished than myself, but you both had a lot of time out there where you were playing sets, and there wasn't a coach there, and there wasn't somebody, and you were just playing somebody else in a match maybe during the week and things of that nature. We don't have that anymore. I love one at Alta. Here in Atlanta, they've got the Alta Challenge Ladder, and it's a great thing, Luke. What they do here with the Atlanta and Bruce, they have the Alta Challenge Ladder. I think they got 200 or 300 kids. It's divided into two separate divisions, and the kids have to get on the phone. They have to call the kid. They have to challenge the kid, and they have to drive to that kid's place if they're challenging them, play them there, and the kids have to do the majority of the setting up. Now, if it's where the kids can't drive, then obviously they, at some point they've got to involve the parents. But the initiation of the call is not made by the parent. It's made by the kids.
That's called ownership, KP.
I'm curious what you guys think of that. You know, what? Because right now, I don't know if, Luke, if you've heard this, but, you know, the 30-minute private lesson, that's been under amazing attack for a long time now. Mm-hmm. And I still treat it a little bit such as a staple. But I use it differently. I want to do what Bruce said. I want to teach them something in that half hour or work on something very specific that they need to add to the package, to add to the technical, you know, toolbox. And then I want them to have the onus on them to go and add and work on that. I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Is that for Bruce?
It's for you. Go ahead. You take one.
Oh, for me. No, I think, you know, you use the word, you know, we're teaching. We're educators. And, you know, some kids are going to grasp it and take ownership that Bruce talked about, you know, more than others. It was interesting. I was watching. There's a 30 on 30, or the ESPN Films has a 30 on 30 with Martina Navratilova and Chris Evert. Chris Evert was an 8-year-old talking about how she liked playing tennis, but she wasn't really a true, you know, nail-biting, glass-eating competitor until she got into her teens. And so sometimes that comes later, but I think as pros, you know, it's really tough because the people who are paying the freight, the parents, they have to see something different. It's like you have to change something all the time instead of like it's instilling the nuts and bolts and the basics and then reinforcing, you know, different skill building sessions, whether it's a half hour, an hour. I can go either way. I as long as it's productive, half an hour are good because you don't have a lot of time. So the kid, you get their full, undivided attention. An hour, I get a little bit more leeway to work on different areas of the court, not just baseline or ground stroke. Sometimes I can get into specialty shots. But educating tennis players is in the mind, in the will, in the spirit, the soul of what we do. And in the end, it's down to the competitor. Are they going to take those lessons learned? And what Bruce said, is the kid going to be jumping rope on their own? Hit on the backboard are they on? How much are they studying just watching tennis? I mean, I used to watch pro tennis all the time on TV. Now they have it right on their phones. You know, what is Djokovic doing? What's Fed doing? What's, you know, the Williams sisters doing? It's all right there. Are they doing it?
I got a funny story. I might embarrass Luke a little bit. I got a funny story from your mother. Your mother tells me the story. You know, I'm concerned about some of my kids not making sure to bring their bags and have their bags, like Bruce said, you know, all together, or maybe you're doing this extra or that. Your mother tells me a story, Luke, about you. I think it was in high school, and you wore your shorts under your jeans to school. And you
That's
told
true.
Your mom,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
You never know when Andre Agassi or somebody's going to come by and want to hit. You were ready at all times.
Well, I'd have lessons in the morning, and then I had to go right, you know, basically I didn't have to. I wanted to. I went right to the tennis courts right after school, and it was just, you know, if I was a waste of time to have to go back to the locker room. So I'd just, you know, be ready to go.
Well, Luke hit the nail on the head right there, JP. He said he wanted to. And I can't tell you that how many kids are doing what they do because mommy and daddy want them to. And, you know, I had a meeting last year with one of the kids I work with, and the parents asked, you know, hey, can we sit down with you, you know, and talk about a couple things? And I said, sure, sure. So we sat down, and they proceeded to tell me that that they were, you know, they were going to get a sports psychologist for the boy, and they were going to get a this for the boy, and they were going to get a that for the boy. And I said, you know, before we start doing all that stuff, maybe we should make sure that he commits to the process that we're in first. And the process that we're in, I've given them mental work. I give them the outlines. I give them the visualization. I give them the relaxation exercises. They're not getting done. I give them the self-talk, you know, the way to talk to yourself on a court, you know, the four P's of self-talk, positive, first person, precise, the present tense. You know, and this is all a result of research that I've done over the years, you know, with myself, with the teams I've coached, with the players I've worked with. You know, so they discard me as a resource because the boy's not doing well, but the boy wasn't doing well because he didn't wake up every day and want to be a player like Luke wanted to be a player. He didn't wake up every day and want to go to the courts. You know, on Friday, he used to want to take Friday off because his friends were all going to the mall. So they take Friday afternoon off and go to the mall. You know, this is, you know, I'd run a specialty camp. You know, we hosted this Mid-Atlantic Tennis Convention here this past weekend. And so Mr. Tim came in. That's my coach. So think about this, JP. If your coach came to town and you've coached these kids for, you know, 5-10 years, and now your coach is coming to town. When I was a kid, I would have been that. I'd have to be dead to not attend. You know, there had to be something really wrong. But not with these kids. You know, these kids, like, you know, they got something else going on or don't feel good or got the sniffles or something. And, you know, and they're not going to do something. They're not going to make a commitment to do it. You know, I tell these kids, hey, Saturday mornings, why don't we get out there at 7 and you can get on the ball machine and you can hit your serves and we can do a half an hour together, a little half hour lesson, and then you can go play your matches. Oh, yeah, I don't want. I get school. You know, I'm tired. I wake up all week early in the morning. Come on now. How are we supposed to make a player out of that? You know, coaches don't make players. Players make players.
And if somebody was listening in to all three of us and wondering what we were talking about and hearing it, they may think we were a little bit negative. Let me ask you this: are we imagining something that did? Are we reminiscing about something that didn't happen, and we're just imagining this? This is to both of you guys, or has there been a? Do you really think there's been this much of a change? Or are we talking, am I talking to two guys that were just incredibly motivated guys? And maybe the rest of the world? I mean,
yeah. No, that's it. You hit the nail on the head. Luke lived in Michigan. Luke, you lived in Michigan, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Yeah, that's not exactly what we'll call tennis weather. You know, so Luke, obviously, and his brother, you know, they were highly motivated, wanted whatever, however it starts, it starts. But at some point in time, you take over and get excited about it, and you want to do it because you got to go out on the court and compete. So absolutely, it's the outliers. You know, it's the outlier kids. You know, and they're in every discipline. There's kids who do math. There's kids who do art. There's kids who do tennis. There's kids who do soccer. There's kids who play whatever. And yeah, it's the kids have to be highly motivated. You know, Federer, he asked his parents at 15, "Can I stop going to school?" I'll never forget Sandin Stolle being at TCU and telling his dad, "Dad, I want to turn pro and play pro tennis." And Fred said, "Sandin, we're going to give you 1 year. And if you can be ranked in the top 250 in 1 year, you don't have to go back to school." And heading into the summertime, Sandin wasn't even close. Then all of a sudden, Sandin went on a run, finishing with the last tournament just good enough to pull himself up to like 234. He didn't go back to school. He was highly motivated. He wanted to be a tennis player. Fred didn't want to play a tennis player. Fred wanted him to go to school and get an education. But Sandin wanted to be a tennis player. So there are the highly motivated people out there, men, women, whoever they might be, children. But, yeah, that's what it is. It's the kids who want it. Because like I said a minute ago, coaches don't make players. Players make players. That alarm goes off, get out of bed. Do you know how much take every kid who wants to be a tennis player, and if they wake up 15 minutes earlier every morning and jump rope for 5 minutes and do push-ups and sit-ups for 10 minutes or some 15 minutes of exercise, that becomes cumulative over time. And what a difference that would make. No one's doing it. Luke, you ever heard of a book called World Class?
I haven't, no. Is that a tennis book?
It's the greatest tennis book written of all time. It's called World Class, and it's by Gene and Bert Boyer, B-O-Y-W-A-R. And it's been out of print for many, many years, but, you know, you can find it on what's that thing called, Amazon?
Amazon, yeah.
Yeah, you can go on Amazon and find it. World Class, yeah. It's the greatest book for a real tennis player that you've ever heard of. And what it does is it basically takes a couple of characters and it melds them together. You know, it takes a couple of the Australians, takes a couple of the Americans, takes Gonzalez, Andres Jimeno, kind of blends their story together. A guy's the son of a groundskeeper. And what I was going to say, my point was, if you heard of it, is that, and I highly recommend it. You'd love to read it if you're a tennis guy who loves tennis. But, you know, it's basically about tennis going from the amateur era before 68 through the open era into the early 70s and how things changed and what it was like to be a junior in the 60s and what it was like to be a, quote, pro after open tennis came about. And the whole thing, you know, it starts off with these various stories about kids getting involved for certain reasons and playing, but it wasn't confusing. You went to the courts, the park, you had an opponent, whatever it was, you played. You know, the ball was in, the ball was out. If the ball was in, you called it in. If the ball was in and you called it out, then you didn't behave that way. It was a gentleman's game. And it was the highest level of respect you had for the sport, for the opponents. And there wasn't, and as JP was saying, there wasn't orange balls and green balls. And which balls were we using this week and which lines are in this week? It was, you know, you couldn't handle the ball. You went on the wall and you hit balls and balls and balls until you could handle the ball. You know, it was just, it's a book I really recommend, but it romanticizes, that's, I guess, the word I'm looking for, tennis, and it puts it in a light of how things were many years ago where you wanted to be a tennis player. And that's, I think, what it comes down to. I was playing number 6 singles and number 3 doubles at Tennessee Chattanooga, but I wanted to still be a pro tennis player. And nobody told me I shouldn't dream that dream. It's okay to dream that dream and work toward it and work. And work longer and work harder and work and work. And then get a job at night so you can afford to have the money so you can practice all day and go try to be a tennis player. Now, they make excuses for the kids. Oh, 1 in 2,000 guys makes it. You probably can't make it. You shouldn't try. You know, get an education. Don't worry about being a pro player. And they don't let them dream the dream. If you don't dream the dream, then what comes next?
Game on. I like that, Bruce. Like check out Handful of Summers.
I've read it. And the second one after it.
Yeah.
Talk about Fred Stallings.
Yeah.
Gavin Forbes. But
let me ask you, Luke, so you in your travels and you're looking and you see these kids and you see what's going on. You know, Bruce answered that. Do you think we're romanticizing this, or do you see anything? They say now that the Russian Federation is the one that's now leading the world and producing the next crop of juniors, not the U.S. They didn't recognize the U.S. They're saying the Russians. They've got, I think it's a place.
That's an ITF stat? That was an ITF thing?
Yeah.
Wow.
Go ahead.
We've got some serious players coming up. I think 7 of the top 8 seeds at Kalamazoo last year turned pro. And these guys are ballers. I mean, we won't know kind of how they play out for the next 3 to 4 years. Taylor Fritz is on the top of that list. He's cruising. But there are some really talented players out of there. Women's side, we still, I think, have some of the most talented players in Sloane Stephens and Madison Keys that haven't really reached their stride yet. And they're a lot below that. I think we have 12 or 13 girls in the top 100. I think it really goes in cycles there. It's not for lack of trying. I mean, we're building a 100-court facility in Orlando, and that's not to be second. That's to kick some serious butt. And I know we're highly motivated, whether it's all three of us and people from all around this country that want to produce the next great American.
You know, I think, Luke, I'd like to add one thing to what Luke just said. And I believe that there's a common denominator sometimes amongst these successful players. And the Taylor Fritz, he grew up in a family. You know, and Peter Smith's kids are good players, and Coach Leach's kids were good players. And a lot of times, you know, Taylor grew up in a family where mom was top 10 in the world. And first husband was Brian Teacher, who knew a little bit about tennis. Second husband, he would play tennis and knew about it. And I think that's a big thing. That the parents, because if you read some articles about Taylor, it was when he was in 10th grade, I believe, and he got invited down to the USTA training, and he was a bit behind all the other kids, and he quit the basketball team in order to go down there for a month to practice with these kids. And when he realized he was behind all these kids, he decided, you know what, I'm catching up and I'm passing them, and I'm going to put the work in. And when he started doing that, he had a mom and a dad at home who understood what it meant to put that work in and what that work required. They didn't say, oh, don't put too much work in and not be a regular kid. You know, don't miss out on going to the parties and stuff. He wanted to put the work in, and he put the work in. And I think that's a big piece of it. You know, these kids who are good and who are talented, that's great. And then to make the jump to the next step, because you know what it's like, Luke, when you go from being a top junior to a college player and then a top college player to a pro, and then you're transitioning level to level, all of this takes time, and there's no shortcuts and no excuses, just work. And the parents have allowed the kids to get there.
Absolutely. I mean, it helps a lot when your parents or you have an uncle or someone who's, you know, climb that mountain and has a perspective on it. And every kid's different. I mean, kids don't come with directions or instructions. And you're just out there just trying to get them better every single day that they still love it and have fun with it and they smile when they get to the tennis court.
You You mentioned the 100-court facilities. You don't think that that lends itself? Some of what you said, both of you said earlier, was, you know, it was a more of an individual thing and an individual thing done with a coach and maybe a small situation, a small group, things of that nature. 100-court facilities and this and that. Does that lend itself to where we need to go, you think?
Time will tell.
Go ahead, Bruce. Yeah.
Time will tell.
I don't think you can
give an answer. You know, England has taken, the Great Britain has taken apart their national facility. A lot of the other countries don't, but maybe in our country it'll be an incubator, and maybe it'll be a place that, you know, I was at Knicks the first year he ever had an academy, and, you know, I was down there in 79 with Anacone and Carita and Mo Kruger and Pablo and Mike DePalmer Jr. and Kathleen Horvath, and Jimmy was down there. And what this was at that point in time was an incubator, Bill Quigley. When you brought all these kids together who didn't play tennis but a couple hours a week in the winter, and then all of a sudden, you know, Paul didn't even really have indoor courts out in the Hamptons, you know. Now we bring these kids together, and there's an incubator where they competed and they battled with each other day in and day out, and it raised the level of everybody's play. You know, so maybe this USTA facility can be an incubator like that for both coaches to share knowledge and to learn from each other, and players to learn to compete against each other and battle, you know, and if so, then I think it can be a great place.
You know, it's interesting. So many people talk about that. You know, I've heard, we've had Ned Caswell on this show, and he's talked about when he was down there, they would play 3 out of 5 sets on the back courts. You know, for 10
at high
for
school
10
somewhere,
bucks,
lock
everybody,
the gate.
Everybody would throw it. Yep. And, Luke, I had your nephews out last week, and it was a rainy day. So I pulled up a old Vic Braden video. I don't know if they told you. May have driven them nuts, but it's an old Vic Braden video, and it talked about, it was Jack Kramer and Pancho Segura.
Ooh,
and they talked about growing up at the L.A. Tennis Center, and
yep.
Pancho at that time, they would go out, you know, Bobby Riggs was there, you know, you had Gonzalez there, you had Jack Kramer, you had Segura and those guys, and they would do the same thing. They would play for $10 a set or something. I suppose with Riggs it was probably a lot more than $10. but you know, it's interesting that incubator idea is great. I think that you're onto something there, Bruce, because I think that would be the way in which it would probably flourish.
Well, take it back a step, JP. Just back up a step off of that. What Luke said before was when he was a kid and somebody would come home from college, you know, he could play these guys and he looked forward to playing them. But, you know, again, just an observation and a theory that can't be proved. But when we had a lot of American guys playing in the college ranks, that meant there were a lot of guys coming home. That meant there were a lot of guys for you to play against if you were a junior. That meant there were a lot of things for you to aspire to when you saw them. And that's probably one of the challenges we're having now with the plethora of international players who are playing college tennis. I mean, in the state of Maryland here where I am, you know, and I'm down in Rockville, we only have men's tennis left in 2 schools in the state of Maryland. That's it. Everyone else has dropped the sport. By the end of this year, we have 2 schools left, St. Mary's and Loyola. And I'm not sure if either one's a scholarship program. You know, whereas years ago
Maryland
when you
went back.
No, Maryland just has women's tennis. There's no men's.
They didn't bring it back. They didn't bring tennis back.
No.
And
so,
UMBC doesn't have it anymore.
They're dropping it, yeah. And Towson has dropped theirs, and all the other schools have dropped theirs. And the only thing that's left, there's 2 schools. So we don't have the college kids in the community, you know, coming home, quote, unquote, on breaks or Christmas or summer for the kids to play. And that's, I don't know what part of the equation that is, but there's something to the equation that involves that.
Yeah, that's a huge loss, Luke. I see that in the junior tennis, and I think it's much, much more important now, or at least it's not important to me, but it makes it difficult as kids get older. If they're not accomplished, it makes it tougher for them because they don't have the like what Bruce says. Do you see any difference?
Well, there's another step in the ladder right there that we're talking about. I mean, that really ticks me off when I see that. I mean, I understand programs want to win and coaches want to win and all this stuff, but the reality is there's $1 trillion student debt in this country. American kids are leaving school, and it's $1 trillion. And I, you know, I'm probably most proud of what I did in my tennis careers at Syracuse University, just recruiting American kids. Now, this isn't solving $1 trillion, you know, debt, but it's in my little way, and it's really sad that American taxpayers are not getting American scholarships in tennis. And how
we just have a couple minutes
Maryland
left. We just have a couple minutes left. How would you solve it? What do you call for?
Well, I mean, there's nothing you can do. I mean, you look at D2, it's even worse. For me, it just coming down to coaches that believe in the American player and believe in developing the American player and all those things. And so it's really sad. And I look at what happened at Syracuse, and they have got 5 kids there from international waters. They didn't even see play. They recruited just based on videos and some type of ranking system and stuff. And so it really kind of guts me a little bit, to be perfectly honest. The reality is each coach has to make their decision, and their AD and their philosophy is, listen, I'm going to be an American coach. This is going to be an American player because we're an American school. And I have no problems with international kids being walk-ons because that's great. But we can't go to their country and get scholarships for playing a sport. Why should they get it here? So that's just my personal take. Is there answers? That's another program, I think, JP.
Bruce, I spoke this past week to Bill Izaki. He's head of our Southern section. I asked him. He said that I told him my observation was that the boys' 16s and 18s draws are down. There's not as much. He confirmed it for me. He says it's terrible. We're going to try and figure out something high school-wise. Do you have a solution to the foreign player problem in college tennis? And we got about 2 minutes left.
Well, first an observation that my whole life tennis has been a fringe sport. It's really not a mainstream sport because it's just too difficult for most people. Most people, it's a confrontational sport. It's you and the person. There's no excuse. So starting with that premise, with the international player, you know, what you've done is you've expanded the depth of college tennis. You know, the height of college tennis, it's no higher than it was when Goldie and the Bryans, you know, at Stanford, and we had plenty of good players out there for years and years and years. And when, you know, Ricky Leach and Jorge Lozano and Luke and these guys are at USC, plenty of height. We've always had height, but the depth is wider. And I can't blame them on the one hand, but the difference is we used to have mostly tennis coaches and some tennis managers. Nowadays, we have mostly tennis managers and not a lot of tennis coaches. You know, there are a few guys out there who are actually coaches who are developing players. Most of the other guys recruit the best player they can get, and then they manage the team. You know, and the new model is get an assistant coach who's knowledgeable and be a manager, which is fine. They're winning championships. They're winning matches. If that's the goal, then that's what they have to do. If you want to reverse it, you need the patience of Job, because it's going to take 20 years to reverse what took 20 years to create. And you're going to have to put limitations on the number of international players who can play. And then eventually, after several generations, people will go into and play because they'll realize there's opportunity there for both scholarship dollars and to reach my potential as a person.
Well, we're almost out of time. Luke, if I had my druthers about it, that money that the USTA is putting in, the millions of dollars into that roof and everything else, I would reward colleges. I would reward if you were the coach at Syracuse and you succeeded and you had all American players on your team, I'd give you $100,000 to put into your program to buy a new ball machine, that fix the program. I'd put my money where my mouth is with that regard. I don't know that I'd put stipulations on whether a school could have players or not, but I do believe that the fact that we do not have coaches choosing American kids, that is why we are losing children in the six. We are losing boys in the 16s and 18s.
Of course, there's nothing to work toward. Of course you are, JP. Yeah. There's nothing to work toward. So they give up. They quit. There's not enough backbone. There's a JP. I'm gonna send you a letter that you can use on your next show for something. And it's a you know my son's up at West Point, and it's a story about and he plays lacrosse up there, and it's a story about a wrestler there who spent 4 years on the bench, never wrestling, but why he went to practice every day and worked hard. And that's a mentality. And you know, our kids get to a certain place, and if there's no payoff, they're out, they're done, they quit. And so sometimes it's just a day too soon.
You guys are gentlemen. You're wonderful for coming on. I appreciate it. I love listening to you guys talk. It was an excellent show. I appreciate it. You saved me. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much. And we'll catch you guys again on another show.
Thank you, Luke. Thanks, JP. It was a pleasure. Have a wonderful day.
All right. Bye.
This has been the We Coach Tennis Radio Show on the Yellow Ball Network. Check in here with us every Tuesday at noon and listen to another great coach talk about what makes their program a success.